You're listening to Unpaused, a podcast for women who want to stage a career comeback or mastermind a new one after an extended break from work. I'm your host, Judy Stewart, and if you want to reclaim your career but don't know how, then this is the podcast for you. Let's meet our guest for today. Today I interview Virginia Braden, founder of Arts Management Australia. As a professional performing artists agent, she managed, advised, nurtured, coached, and grew close to some of the most talented people in the performing arts in Australia and overseas, through the highs and inevitable lows of performance success. In the process, Virginia got to understand the art, science, and serendipity of how a successful career can be knitted together from a series of standalone roles and opportunities, if it's done well. You'll hear Virginia's top two pieces of advice about commitment that she's given again and again to artists wanting to come back after a professional setback or hiatus, and what it takes if they truly want to get back on the road to the top. You'll also hear about some of the peculiar challenges that women in the arts have to juggle once they become famous. Every aspect of their appearance, how they speak, pulling themselves together after an emotionally charged performance, and generally managing themselves to the point where they can make it look easy. I met Virginia when we sat side by side for 6 years on the board of Opera Australia, but I knew her by reputation for many years before that. Let's start with how Virginia's career in the arts began to take shape in her early 20s.
I think my interest in the arts really started with my parents, who were both mad keen on music, and from a very early age I was seeped into not only going to performances but also learning the piano and ballet. So that was the sort of background that I've really taken into my whole life. I had a lot of very interesting and small level jobs early on after I finished university. But I suppose when I moved to Sydney in the 70s, I got a job as manager of the first Sydney International Piano Competition. I'm not really to this day quite sure how I managed to get myself qualified for this.
Big job, Virginia.
It was a little bit the blind leading the blind, because a major arts patron, Claire Dan, and the then director of the conservatorium had the idea of setting up an international piano competition, but they'd given themselves only a year in which to actually realise the dream and get it on. And I walked into the job a year before and I suppose spent pretty much a mind-numbing year just trying to push the whole thing forward.
Virginia, let me stop you there for a minute, because perhaps people won't always understand how there is a world of international piano competitions taking place. It's quite interesting how it affects someone's career to win, especially one of the prestigious ones. What are the important ones, and how does that whole world of piano competitions work?
Well, I do think it's interesting because that really was the beginning of me setting up my whole business and the interest in artist careers. So the international piano competition scene is a very big one around the world now. When we set up the Sydney International Piano Competition, perhaps it wasn't quite so big, but it does have a governing body which is based in Geneva, which has membership of all of the best competitions and sets down certain rules and requirements which you have to conform to. So it is genuinely an international movement. There are, of course, some very, very famous competitions which were going well before Sydney started up, and that includes competitions like the Van Cliburn in America, the Tchaikovsky in Moscow, the Queen Elizabeth in Belgium, the Leeds competition in England, and there are now many, not only piano competitions, but competitions for a number of different instruments and also the voice. So there is a kind of worldwide control over when people are going to hold their competitions to make sure there aren't major clashes. and also, I suppose, to make sure that people aren't going against the basic rules of competition.
So if someone comes into the competition and excels, you know, wins first prize or second prize, what's the significance of that?
Well, very occasionally, and it's rarer than you might think, you have winners like Ashkenazi, like Pollini, who have burst onto the scene with a first prize win in a big competition and have never looked back and have made very famous careers. There are quite a few famous pianists, on the other hand, who have thumbed their noses at competitions, like Kissin and others who've refused to go into competitions. And the majority are just very fine pianists who, if they win the first prize or the second prize or you know, really from one to six, I guess, they can reasonably guarantee, I think, a decent career. And some of them do make it to the top and others of them don't. The competition isn't the be-all and end-all of a person's career. It's really just the beginning of it.
So to go back to Virginia Braden's career, the piano competition was obviously critical to your next step.
The piano competition was critical in one major way, and that was in 1977 when we had the first one. I suddenly became terribly aware of the fact that we were dealing with young people who just didn't have a clue how to run their careers. And I think it still happens to this day, and I think that's an absolutely vital thing. Mm. So when I managed the first and the second piano competition, and then I got a job as director of the Australian Music Centre, which for a variety of reasons I won't bore you with, didn't work out. And I was left, because they ran out of money basically, and I was left really wondering what on earth I was going to do. And it's at that point that I set up my career as a runner of a business, I guess. I just decided that I would try to find freelance work and start my business, which was called Arts Management. And so I started in 1979.
Representing artists, performing
well,
artists.
Well, it wasn't immediately representing artists because I was so desperate for work of any kind. I took a lot of research work projects and all sorts of work, whatever I could get from the Australia Council and many other sources. And in fact, it was the Australian conductor, Stuart Challander, who just kept on saying to me, you must manage artists and I want you to manage me. And at first I said, no, I know nothing about artist management and I can't do it. But it was actually Stuart Challander who arrived on my doorstep with a bottle of wine and said, I'm going to talk you into it, and finally agreed that I would represent him.
Wow. And how old were you then, Virginia?
I was 32. I just decided that if he was so desperate to have management and couldn't find anyone else, it might as well be me. Mm. And I might as well find out about it.
Mm, work it out together.
But at the same time, and this was a very, very good piece of luck, one of the people who had been working with me in the Sydney International Piano Competition was another young Australian woman called Jenny Vogel, who had just come out to do the piano competition as a kind of short-term job. But her real job was working with an artist management company in London called Harrison Parrott. And the following year, after I'd set up my business, I went to see her at Harrison Parrott and met everybody who worked there, and they were very, very keen to offer me local management for a number of very good musicians. Things changed after that, but I accepted several very good clients who I had for the entire time that I ran Arts Management, and that really started me off on a tremendous boost for my business.
And what did actually managing them involve? Was it finding them engagements, or was it more prosaic than that, or was it all of that and everything in between?
I think it really depends very much on the level of the artist and where they stand in their career. The basic things, of course, are to try to find work for them. Other things which are very important is to give them the right advice about contracts and the right advice about what they should either accept or not accept. And even things like repertoire advice or stage performance, a whole bunch of things which have to do with managing a career. And then, of course, very quickly on top of that come recording contracts and television appearances. And then there's a whole raft of media rights and things which you have to help them with. And I guess it was just a question of sink or swim in my case. I asked an awful lot of questions. I burnt a lot of midnight oil, especially in the early days. and was lucky enough to have friends and colleagues who were prepared to answer questions, and that's how I got on. And I guess I figured that if no one else was going to do it in Sydney particularly, then I might as well be doing it. There was at that time one other manager in Melbourne, Jennifer Eddy, that her principal focus was singers, and she was not interested in instrumentalists or directors and designers and lighting designers, which I started getting very interested in. So she encouraged me, in fact, to start up because there was far too much work for her alone. And in the end, after I'd got going, she even encouraged me to take on singers because there were more singers than she could handle.
And you did do that?
And I did, yes.
And so that must have been fascinating, Virginia. And obviously you must have been working very hard here in Australia, but it must have taken you all over the world because you would have had to have networked with other agents and other venue managers and CEOs of arts organisations who were looking for talent, and you were putting your talent forward, presumably.
Well, that's pretty much how it started, because the British firm Harrison Parrott had given me the local management of several artists, and they included people like Christopher Hogwood and Stephen Bishop Kovacevic, as he was in those days, a lot of very good artists. Then I almost had the international connection built. And in those days, there was something called the British Association of Concert Managers. And Jennifer Eddy and I decided that we both needed some international sort of support from an organisation. And we both together approached this British association and asked whether we could belong. And interestingly, I guess they had their mind a little bit on internationalisation because they accepted us. And very, very quickly after that, everybody realised that it was ridiculous to have international members with a name like British Association, so they changed it to the International Association. And I gradually became very involved in the running of that. I was on the board for a long time. I was deputy chairman for quite a time, and then I became chairman. And so I was chairman of it for 4 years as well. And I still retain, even to this day, a very close link with IAMA.
So, Virginia, to bring it around to my subject, which is where people have extended absences from work for whatever reason, did you see much of this amongst the artists with whom you work, where they would be injured or they would have family or personal health issues or maybe a catastrophic performance issue and they've had to regroup and come back from a very difficult position? Did you have much experience of that?
Oh, a lot. I can't tell you how much. I mean, the first, I suppose, the most obvious thing was the terrible dilemma of the young woman performers who were married and wondering how to plan having the children. You know, at what point you can do that. And for a singer, at what point in the cycle of having accepted roles which get offered to you and you accept years in advance, and how do you break it? And then at what point can you decide that you're going to go away? Are you going to spend, you know, what, 6 months or at least 4 months waiting for the baby to arrive? And then the whole business of what happens. Is the baby an easy one? Can you get back to work? How do you plan it? Is there a role for you when you come back? Who else has stepped into your shoes while you were away? That kind of thing. So the singers are really very obvious. I think probably conductors and instrumentalists are less obvious, but there have been a lot of very difficult issues over my time about retirement, for example. If you go to the other end of the spectrum with singers, at what time do you have to start having the conversation with the singer about the fact that their voices are not what they used to be and they're not getting enough work and that they really should consider retiring? And helping them and trying to mentor them through the whole process of retirement, which is a very, very difficult thing for most performers to accept.
But, I mean, retirement doesn't have to mean sitting at home and digging in the garden. I mean, presumably, because it can happen quite young in a career, can't it? I mean, you know, it's not like they're 70. It could be at 50.
Oh, well, I think it can be earlier. there are a number of singers that I can think of, both Australian and international, who just for some reason or other haven't had a voice which has appealed to the particular artistic directors who've been working at the time. And then if they don't get cast in roles of their opera singers or in concert, get asked to perform concerts, the question is at what point can they have to say to themselves, I can't keep my voice going. Voices need a lot of work, they need a lot of practice, but they also need the performance. And if they don't get it, the voice goes downhill. And some of those singers who would be regarded very highly, maybe in some other arena, have really just had to fade away at the age of, mid-30s. And that is a very, very sad experience to have to talk people through that, because their reaction is, well, why can't they have me? Why can't they take me? And then, of course, in Australia too, there are quite a number of singers who all compete for the same roles and only one person gets cast in. There are a lot of disappointments for performers along the way, and I guess that's how I got so interested in mentoring, is to try and help mentor people through a number of crises that they have in their lives. Some of them as performers and others of them, and I can think of a lot that came into this category, of people who've been artistic director of organisations where it hasn't worked out and they've been asked to leave, or they've been told their contracts are not going to be renewed. And that does have a very profound effect on people, and they require a lot of mentoring and talking through the issues.
It's a high-stakes game, isn't it, the performing arts? I mean, great to be on top, but for everyone that's riding the wave of success, there are another 100 who are struggling, maybe more.
And then I can think of examples where in their late 20s and early to mid-30s, a singer has not been popular with an artistic director and hasn't got any work, and then suddenly the artistic director changes and they're incredibly popular. And so the career suddenly takes up a leap, which is, wonderful to see.
Yes, there's so much to do with personality in life, isn't there? You know, you can have the greatest talent in the world, but if you haven't got that personality that people are drawn to, you can really, I've seen it, as you have. Artistic directors, they can be very harsh, and if you're out, you're out.
If you become demanding and get offside with the management or get offside with the artists that you're dealing with, it can be very brutal. But also the world is brutal, because if you don't have enough good ideas quickly enough, or if they don't conform to the marketing requirements, and the ideas might be terrific but they don't sell tickets, there are all sorts of factors which plug into these situations. It's not only talent, it's kind of basic instincts and learning how to really make the system work for you. There are a lot of issues.
So when you're advising, I mean, you must have done, I can't imagine how much advice you must have given over the course of your career, including to me.
Well, the thing that I agonise over is how good is the advice?
No, I think it's pretty good, Virginia. I think you're a good listener. You're a very good listener, which is obviously important. But in giving all this advice, you obviously have a very good grasp of the realities. You have to sometimes speak very frankly about what is what.
And it's terribly hard.
Terribly hard. But still, someone sometimes needs someone to be hard with them, because really there's no alternative. But looking back, do you think, with the things that you would say to someone who's been in the career doldrums, and what advice would you give them? What would be the two top things that you'd routinely say to people who are on the outside and who are very keen to get back into the swim, assuming that all of the other important things are given, the talent's there, the roles are there, et cetera, et cetera?
The two top advice things are, how badly do you really want to do this? Because this is going to be very, very hard, and you are going to have to make sacrifices with your family, with your children, with the number of hours you work, with the amount of money that you pour into keeping yourself in tip-top condition. And then how much are you prepared to work on your own and work with a support group of teachers and so on, and just constantly put yourself forward for work that you know you can do. And if you've got enough patience to stick it out, and if you've got the temperament to be prepared to accept that and not let it agonize you all the time, which affects your personality and it actually affects your performance, then do it. But if you feel that you just haven't got the strength for that, and particularly for people who are young enough to rethink a career and either branch off into something else like music teaching, or, you know, there are a lot of other things now. The options are very big because there's the whole tech industry, there's streaming and all those things. There are recordings, there's television. There are a number of things which would find a music background useful. And then you have to seriously say to people, you want to look at the alternatives as well. Don't just concentrate on being a soloist or an opera star. Know yourself well enough to know that you have to back off and do something else. The thing about management too, which is really interesting, is that when you start off with people, you're starting off trying to build their whole attitude towards performance and being a professional performer. But then when you represent people who've got a huge career, the requirements of a manager change a lot. They go from telling people how to build a career to actually helping them fend off all of the pressures which come onto them when they become famous. So dealing with the media, telling people that they won't do certain things, protecting them as much as you can. And it's more, instead of telling people that they must say yes to things, you're actually telling the really famous people that they have to say no a lot of the time. And it's a very big shift in the management attitude.
What's your observation about women in the performing arts over the years? There's a lot in the press about women at the moment. There's a huge amount about how they're underrepresented in almost every area. But what's your observation about that?
So far, to my knowledge, and I could be wrong about this, there isn't a conductor of the level, a woman conductor of the level of, say, Von Karajan. Mm. Now, why is this? I don't know. Is it because he just had the sharp elbows and the determination and the relentlessness to promote himself into something pretty amazing, which he did do, of course. And there are a number of other conductors that you can think of who are enormously famous, but all of them are men. The next level down, there are some very fine women conductors. But, you know, it gets back to sort of very mundane things. Like, a lot of women couldn't handle that enormous amount of responsibility and indeed power, because they also want to have children, they want to have other things in their lives. And I think in many ways women are more all-rounded as performers as a result of that. They're not as relentless as males. And I guess I come from the generation where I certainly wouldn't want to be appointed to anything if I were just being appointed because I was a woman. I want to be competitive with everybody, men and women. And it's probable that many conductors and other women instrumentalists feel like that as well. Women have become more famous, say, in playing the piano than they have been in conducting. There are some very famous women violinists, Sophie Mutter and people like that, Kyung-hwa Chung, and people who've made very, very big careers. The difference, I suppose, in a way, is very mundane, and that is that men, by and large, have wives who look after their every sort of need, from their dress shirts for performances, and feeding them and packing for them and making sure that everything in their life is smooth and they just can concentrate on their music. Whereas I think women performers in general still suffer, much as I hate to say it, still suffer from having to look after children and be planners for what's going to happen. If they're going away on tour, who's going to look after the kids? All sorts of minute things that shouldn't probably get in the way. Mm. I can't think of many women performers actually who've chosen not to marry or have children just because they wanted to concentrate solely on their performances.
But you could understand if they did.
Oh, I do, because the thing that you would say if I was a woman performer, the first thing I'd say is I need a wife.
Just been having that conversation about Madeleine Albright when she was the US ambassador to the UN. Her sister became her wife.
I saw that because I am, with your encouragement, reading that book and loving it. Yeah. And finding it, she's a very human person, but she's the sort of person who can admit to those difficulties. Yeah. Whereas I think if you read a biography written by a man or an autobiography, they would not be talking about those sorts of things. But I found it a very, very warm human.
That's because they don't have to buy the yogurt, Virginia. You know, Madeleine Albright had the sign up and note up on the fridge. I see Idi Amin, oh, buy the yogurt.
A wonderful example of one of the really lovely singers that I represented, the soprano. She made a very good career, but then she got married and then she had two little boys successively. And she said, before I had these children, I had my routine before the opening night of a big, if I'm singing the lead role in an opera, and the routine lasted the whole day, how to rest, how to exercise, what I was going to eat, was I going to have my hair done, what I was going to wear, how early I get to the theatre to get into makeup and costume and warm up and all those things. And she said what she discovered when she had two little boys was somebody had glue ear or something, and she found herself 2 hours before the opening night of a major role at the children's hospital, struggling with one screaming child and one child that was on a trolley being examined by a doctor and probably vomiting on the floor. Mm. And she said, so it really, really brings you to reality what that's like. But by the same token, she said she thought in the end it probably helped her to be very organised in her life and use her time much more efficiently.
You touched on something there, Virginia, that I just touch on in the book, but it's how women present themselves when they want to change direction. And part of that presentation is what they wear, how they look, how they comport themselves. And it's interesting to watch in the performing arts. She's got to get her hair done, she's got to get the costume right, or if it's a concert performance, she's got to have the dress right. I mean, an enormous amount of thought goes into what they wear on stage outside the formal costuming of a formal opera. And it's completely normal to step into your identity by dressing yourself in a certain way. And yet women feel like they're not being taken seriously if they spend a minute admitting to spending any time on their appearance.
Well, that's sort of the art of the deception, isn't it, really? I mean, clever women probably don't admit in the public arena that they do all of that sort of stuff. But you know that the phrase power dressing really emanated. When did it start? I suppose in the early 80s, when women realised progressively the importance of actually developing a persona and developing a style which would be recognisable. And it's a terrible thing to say, but it's probably true to say that men have never had that kind of pressure.
Oh, no, they don't. No.
There are certain requirements for a man, but it's nowhere near the same. That's all to do with really managing your career in a way, if you're a performing artist, is, okay, how much time are you going to devote to this and how are you going to do it? Because the minute you get off stage on opening night, you then have to have another outfit to get into for the after party, where you're the person that everybody, several hundred people in a room, will be looking at, will be admiring, will be clapping,
criticising. If it's
and
not right.
Somebody will get up behind a microphone and talk about everybody's performances, and you have to be there looking your most confident that you can be. Having adrenaline coursing through you because you've just come off 3 hours of singing. And all those things are very important in performance. Some people say, oh, dressing is just superficial and you don't need to worry about it, but I don't agree with that at all. I just think you have to manage yourself to the point where you can make it look easy.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Unpaused. I'd love you to subscribe on iTunes or share the podcast with someone you think might like it. You can find the show notes or sign up for news on my website, unpaused.net, or see what we're up to on Instagram or my LinkedIn page. Bye for now.